Tug did not make any answer to Daniel's proposition immediately, but Daniel saw the faintest gleam of relief in his gaze. Tug drew a breath. "And in return for your silence? You will finance Victor Umeru's counter-revolution against Tafari's regime. After all, it won't be the first coup in Africa that you've orchestrated, Tug, will it?" "How much will it cost me?" Tug asked. "Only a small fraction of what you would lose if I were to release the tape before you have a chance to pull out. I could get a copy around to the Foreign Office and another to the American ambassador within 30 minutes. It could be on BBC One at 6 o'clock. "How much?" Tug insisted. $5 million in cash paid into a Swiss account immediately. With you as the signatory, and Umeru as a counter-signatory. And what else? You'll intercede with the President of Zaire. He is a friend of yours, but no friend of Tafari's. We want him to allow clandestine passage of arms and musicians across his border with Yuboma. All he has to do is turn a blind eye. Is that all? That's the lot, Daniel nodded. All right, I agree, Tug said. Give me the account number and I'll deposit the money before noon tomorrow. Daniel stood up. Cheer up, all is not lost, Tug, he advised. Victor Umeru will be very kindly disposed towards you once he is reinstated in his rightful position. I am sure he'll be prepared to renegotiate the contract with you, with the proper safeguards in place this time. After Daniel had left, Tug Harrison sat staring at his Picasso for fully 5 minutes. Then he glanced at his watch. There was a 9-hour time difference in Taipei. He picked up the telephone and dialed the international code, followed by Ningheng Sui's private number. The old man's eldest son, Fang, screened the call, and then passed him on to his father. "I have a very interesting proposition for you," Tug told the old man. "I want to fly out to speak to you face to face. I can be in Taipei within 24 hours. Will you be there?" He made 2 other phone calls, one to his chief pilot's home number to warn him to get the Gulfstream ready, and the second to the Credit Suisse Bank in Zurich. "Mr. Milder, I will be making a large transfer from the number 2 account within the next 24 hours. 5 million sterling. Make certain there is no delay once you receive the code card instruction." Then he hung up the telephone and stared at the painting again without seeing it. He had decided what reason he would give Ning for wanting to sell his share in UDC. Should he say that he was in a cash bind, or that he needed to be liquid for a new acquisition? Which would Ning fall for more readily? What was his price? He mustn't set it too low, for that would arouse the cunning old Oriental's suspicions immediately. Not too high, either. Low enough to excite his greed, high enough not to alarm him. It was a nice calculation. He would have the duration of the flight to Taipei to consider it. "That young fool Cheng has dropped me in it. It's only right that his father be made to pay." He thought about Ning Cheng Gong. "He's been too good a choice," Tug smiled bitterly. He had asked for a ruthless one, and got more than he bid for. Of course Tug had known about the forced labour, but not the details of their treatment. He had not wanted to know. Neither had he known for certain about the use of the arsenic reagents, though he had suspected that Cheng was using them. The platinum recovery figures had been too high, the profits too good for it not to be so. He had not wanted to know any of the unpleasant details. But he thought philosophically the enhanced profitability of the mining venture would make it easier to sell out his interests to Lucky Dragon. Ningheng Sui would think he was getting the bargain of his life. "Good luck, Lucky Dragon," Tug grunted. "You're going to need all of it." 3 months to the day since last crossing, Daniel stood on the moraine below the Ruwatamagufu Glacier. This time he was properly equipped for the alpine conditions. There would be no more frostbite, and this time he was not alone. The line of porters, each man bowed forward against the headband of his pack, stretched back as far as Daniel could see into the mountain mist. They were all men of the Konjo tribe, Dur mountaineers who could carry heavy loads at these high altitudes. There were 650 porters, and each man carried an 80-pound pack. In all, that made 26 tons of arms and ammunition. There were no sophisticated weapons in the loads, only the tried and true tools of the guerrilla and the terrorist, the ubiquitous AK-47 and the Uzi, the RPD light machine gun and the RPG rocket launcher, to Cardiff automatic pistols and American M-26 fragmentation grenades, or at least convincing copies of them made in Yugoslavia or Romania. All of these were readily obtainable at short notice in any quantity required, as long as the buyer had cash. Daniel was amazed how easy it had been. Tug Harrison had supplied him with the names and telephone numbers of 5 dealers, 1 in Florida, 2 in Europe, and 2 in the Middle East. "Take your pick," Tug had invited, "but check what you're getting before you pay. Some of that stuff has been floating around for 40 years. Daniel and his instructors had personally opened every single case and laboriously checked each piece. Daniel had calculated that the very minimum number of instructors he needed was 4. He went back to Zimbabwe to find them. They were all men he had fought with or against during the Bush War. They were all Swahili speakers and they were all black. A white face attracted a lot of attention in Uboma. The leader of the group of 4 was an ex-sergeant major in the Ballantyne Scouts, a man who had fought with men like Roland Ballantyne and Sean Courtney. He was a magnificent figure of a Matabele warrior called Morgan Tembe. There was another recruit in the party, a cameraman, to replace Bonnie Mahoon. Shadrach Mbeki was a black South African exile who had done good work for the BBC, the best man that Daniel could find at such short notice. To the north, Mount Stanley was hidden in clouds, and the cloud dropped down to form a grey, cold ceiling only 100 feet above their heads. But to the east, below the cloud, it was open. Daniel gazed down upon the forest almost 10,000 feet below. It looked like the ocean, green and endless, except to the north where a dark cancer had bitten into the green. The open mined area was deeper and wider than when Daniel had last seen it from this vantage point only a few short months ago. The cloud and the mist dropped over them abruptly, blotting out the distant carnage, and Daniel roused himself and started down, the long column of porters unwinding behind him. Seppu was waiting for him, where the bamboo forest began, at the 10,000-foot level. "It is good to see you again, Kuokua, my brother. Karakai sends you her heart," he told Daniel. "She asks that you come to her swiftly. She says she can wait no longer." The men of Seppu's clan had cut out the trail through the bamboo, widening it so that the porters could pass through without having to stoop. Below the bamboo, where the true rainforest began, at the 6,000-foot level, Patrick O'Meara was waiting with his teams of Uhali recruits to take over from the Konjo mountaineers. Daniel paid off the Konjo and watched them climb back through the bamboo into their misty highlands. Then the Bambuti guided them onto the newly opened trail back towards Gondala. After Kelly's message, Daniel could not restrain himself to the pace of the heavily laden convoy, and he and Seppu hurried ahead. Kelly was on the trail coming to meet them, and they came upon each other suddenly around a bend in the forest path. Kelly and Daniel came up short and stared at each other. Neither of them seemed able to move or even to speak, until Kelly said huskily, without taking her eyes from Daniel's face, "Go on ahead, Seppu. Far, far ahead." Seppu giggled happily and went without looking back. During Daniel's absence, Victor O'Meara had built his new headquarters in the edge of the forest beyond the waterfall at Gondala, where it would be hidden from any possible aerial surveillance. It was a simple barazza with half walls and a thatched roof. He sat with Daniel on the raised dais at one end of the hut. Daniel was meeting the resistance leaders, many of them for the first time. They were seated facing the dais on long split-pole benches like students in a lecture theatre. There were 38 of them. Mostly Uhali tribesmen, but 6 were influential Haita who were disenchanted with Tafari and had thrown in their lot with Victor O'Meara as soon as they heard that he was still alive. These Haita were vital to the plan of action that Daniel had devised and discussed with Victor. 2 of them were highly placed in the army and 1 was a senior police officer. The other 3 were government officials who would be able to arrange permits and licenses for travel and transport. All of them would be able to supply vital intelligence. At first there had been some natural objection to Daniel's new cameraman filming the proceedings, but Victor had interceded, and now Shadrach Mbeki was working so unobtrusively that they soon forgot his presence. As a reward for his assistance, Victor O'Meara had agreed that Daniel could make a film record of the entire campaign. Daniel opened the meeting by introducing his 4 Matabele military instructors. As each man rose and faced the audience, Daniel recited his curriculum vitae. They were all impressive men, but Morgan Tembe in particular they regarded with awe. "Between them they've trained thousands of fighting men," Daniel told them. They won't be interested in parade ground drills or spit and polish. They'll simply teach you to use the weapons we've brought over the mountains and to use them to the best possible effect. He looked at Patrick Omeru in the front row. Patrick, can you come up here and tell us how many men you have at your disposal and where they are at the present time? Patrick had been busy during Daniel's absence. He had recruited almost 1,500 young men. Well done, Patrick. That's more than we need, Daniel told him. I was planning on a corps of 1,000 men, four units of 250, each under the command of one of the instructors. More than that will be difficult to conceal and deploy. However, we'll be able to use the others in non-combatant roles. The staff conference went on for 3 days. At the last session, Daniel addressed them again. Our plans are simple. That makes them good. There is less to go wrong. Our whole strategy is based on two principles. Number one is that we have to move fast. We have to be in a position to strike within weeks rather than months. Number two is that it's a total surprise. Our security must be ironclad. If Tafari gets even a whiff of our plans, he'll crack down so hard that we'll have no chance of success whatsoever. There it is, gentlemen, speed and stealth. We'll meet again here on the 1st of next month. By then, President Omeru and I will have a detailed plan of action drawn up. Until then, you'll be taking orders from your instructors in the training camps. Good luck to all of us. Piri was confused and angry and filled with formless despair and hatred. For months now, he had lived alone in the forest with not another man to talk to or woman to laugh with. At night, he lay alone in his carelessly built leaf hut far from the huts of other men, and he thought of his youngest wife. She was 16 years of age, with plump little breasts. He remembered the wetness and lubricious warmth of her body, and he moaned aloud in the darkness as he thought that he would never again know the comfort of a woman's body. During the day he was lethargic and without care. He no longer hunted with his old intensity. Sometimes he sat for hours gazing into one of the dark forest pools. Twice he heard the honey chameleon call, and he did not follow. He grew thin, and his beard began turning white. Once he heard a party of Bambuti women in the forest, laughing and chattering as they gathered mushrooms and roots. He crept close and spied upon them, and his heart felt as though it would break. He longed to join them, but knew he could not. Then one day, while wandering alone, Piri cut the trail of a party of Wazungu. He studied their tracks and read that there were 20 of them, and that they had moved with purpose and determination, as though on a journey. It was exceedingly strange to find other men in the forest, for the Haita and Uhali were afraid of hobgoblins and monsters and never entered the tall trees if they could avoid doing so. Piri recovered a little of his old curiosity, and he followed the tracks of the Wazungu. They were moving well, and it took him many hours to catch up with them. Then he discovered a most remarkable thing. Deep in the forest he found a camp where many men were assembled. They were all armed with the banduki that had a strange banana-shaped appendage hanging from beneath, either a tail or a penis, Piri was not certain. And while Piri watched in astonishment from his hiding place, these men fired their banduki and made a terrible clattering clamour that frightened the birds into flight and sent the monkeys scampering away across the forest galleries. All this was extraordinary. But most marvellous of all was that these men were not Haita. These days only Haita soldiers in uniform carried banduki. These men were Uhali. Piri thought about what he had seen for many days, and then the acquisitive instinct, which had been dormant in him since the coming of the Mulimo, began to stir. He thought about Chetty Singh, and wondered if Chetty Singh would give him tobacco if he told him about the armed men in the forest. He hated Chetty Singh, who had cheated and lied to him, but as he thought about the tobacco, the saliva jetted from under his tongue. He could almost taste it in his mouth. The old tobacco hunger was like a pain in his chest and his belly. The next day he went to find Chetty Singh, and he whistled and sang as he went. He was coming alive again after the Mulimo death. He stopped only once to hunt a colobus monkey that he spied in the treetops, eating the yellow fruit of the Mongongo tree. His old skills came back to him, and he crept to within 20 paces of the monkey without its suspecting his presence, and he shot a poisoned arrow that struck one of its legs. The monkey fled shrieking through the branches, but it did not go far before it fell to earth, paralysed by the poison, its lips curled up in the dreadful rictus of agony as it frothed and trembled and shook before it died. The poison on Piri's arrow was fresh and strong. He had found the nest of the little beetles only days before, and had dug them up and crushed them to paste in a bark crucible and smeared his arrow tips with the juices. With his belly full of monkey meat, and the wet skin folded into his bark fibre bag, he went on towards the rendezvous with the one-armed Sikh. Piri waited 2 days at the rendezvous, the clearing in the forest that had once been a logging camp, but was now overgrown and reverted to jungle. He wondered if the Yuhali storekeeper who kept the little dukkha on the side of the main highway had passed on his message to Chetty Singh. Then he began to believe that Chetty Singh had received the message but would not come to him. Perhaps Chetty Singh had learned of the Mulimo death and was also ostracizing him. Perhaps nobody would ever speak to Piri again. His recent high spirits faded as he sat alone in the forest waiting for Chetty Singh to come, and the sense of despair and confusion overwhelmed him all over again. Chetty Singh came on the afternoon of the second day. Piri heard his Land Rover long before it arrived, and suddenly his anger and hatred had something on which to focus. He thought how Chetty Singh had cheated and tricked him so many times before. He thought how he had never given him everything he had promised. Always there was short weight of tobacco and water in the gin. Then he thought how Chetty Singh had made him kill the elephant. Piri had never been as angry as he was now. He was too angry even to lash out at the trees around him, too angry to shout aloud. His throat was tight and closed, and his hands shook. Chetty Singh was the one who had brought the curse of the Mulimo down upon him. Chetty Singh had killed his soul. Now he forgot about the armed Wazungu in the forest. He even forgot about the tobacco hunger as he waited for Chetty Singh to come. The mud-streaked Land Rover butted its way into the clearing, pushing down the thick secondary growth of vegetation ahead of it. It stopped, and the door opened, and Chetty Singh stepped down. He looked around him at the forest and wiped his face with a white cloth. He had put on much weight recently. He was plumper now than he had been before he had lost the arm. His shirt was stained dark with sweat between his shoulder blades, where he had sat against the leather seat. He mopped his face and adjusted his turban before he shouted into the forest, "Piri, come out!" Piri sniggered with laughter and whispered aloud, mimicking the Sikh, "Piri, come out!" And then his voice was bitter. "See how he oozes grease like a joint of pork on the coals. Piri, come out!" Chetty Singh strutted around the clearing impatiently. After a while he opened his fly and urinated. Then he zipped his trousers and looked at his wristwatch. "Piri, are you not there?" Piri did not answer him, and Chetty Singh said something angrily in a language that Piri did not understand, but he knew that it was an insult. "I am going now," Chetty Singh shouted, and marched back to the Land Rover. "Oh, master!" Piri called to him. "I see you. Do not go." Chetty Singh spun around to face the forest. "Where are you?" he shouted. "I am here, oh, master. I have something for you that will make you very happy, something of great value." "What is it?" Chetty Singh asked. "Where are you?" "Here I am." Piri stepped out of the shadows with the bow slung over his shoulder. "What stupidity is this?" Chetty Singh demanded. "Why do you hide from me?" "I am your slave," Piri grinned ingratiatingly, "and I have a gift for you." "What is it? Elephant teeth?" Chetty Singh asked, and there was greed in his voice. "Better than that. Something of greater value." "Show me," Chetty Singh demanded. "Will you give me tobacco?" "I will give you as much tobacco as the gift is worth."
"I will show you," Piri agreed. "Follow me, O master."
"Where is it? How far is it?"
"Only a short distance. Only that far."
Piri indicated a small arc of the sky with two fingers, less than an hour's travel.
Chetty Singh looked dubious.
"It is a thing of great beauty and value," Piri wheedled. "You will be very pleased."
"All right," the Sikh agreed. "Lead me to this treasure."
Piri went slowly, allowing Chetty Singh to keep close behind him. He went in a wide circle through the densest part of the forest, crossing the same stream twice. There was no sun in the forest. A man steered by the fall of the land and the run of the rivers. Piri showed Chetty Singh the same river twice from different directions, By now the Sikh was totally lost, blundering blindly after the little pygmy with no sense of distance or direction. After the second hour, Chetty Singh was sweating very heavily, and his voice was rough.
"How much further is it?" he asked.
"Very close," Piri assured him.
"I will rest for a while," Chetty Singh said, and sat down on a log.
When he looked up again, Piri had vanished. Chetty Singh was not alarmed. He was accustomed to the elusive comings and goings of the Bambuti.
"Come back here," he ordered.
But there was no reply. Chetty Singh sat alone for a long time. Once or twice he called out to the pygmy. Each time his voice was shriller. The panic was building up in him. After another hour he was pleading.
"Please, Piri, I will give you anything you ask. Please show yourself."
Piri laughed. His laughter floated through the trees, and Chetty Singh sprang to his feet and plunged off the faint track. He stumbled towards where he thought he had heard the laughter.
"Piri," he begged, "please come to me."
But the laughter came from a new direction. Chetty Singh ran towards it. After a while he stopped and looked about him wildly. He was streaming with sweat and panting. Laughter, mocking and faint, trembled in the humid air. Chetty Singh turned around and staggered after it. It was like chasing a butterfly or a puff of smoke. The sound flitted and flirted through the trees, first from one direction and then the other. Chetty Singh was weeping now. His turban had come loose and hooked on a branch, and he did not stop to retrieve it. His hair and beard tumbled down, streaming down his chest and flying out behind him. His hair was soaked with sweat. He fell and dragged himself up and ran on, his clothing stained with mud and leaf mould. He screamed his terror to the trees, and the laughter became fainter and fainter, until at last he heard it no more.